As the civil rights movement gained momentum and intensity, so did the black Muslims, whose leader was Elijah Muhammad, but whose minister and primary spokesman was Malcolm X. Born Malcolm Little in Omaha, Nebraska, as a young man he went to prison for robbery. In prison, he found religion. Following a disagreement with Muhammad, Malcolm split from the black Muslims to form his own group, the Organization for Afro-American Unity. On March 29, 1964, he spoke to a group in Harlem. He was assassinated less than a year later.
Americans, or a so-called Negro, when you have a philosophy or a gospel, I don't care whether it's a religious gospel, a political gospel, an economic gospel, or a social gospel, if it's not going to do something for you and me right here, right now, to hell with that gospel. In the past, most of the religious gospels that you and I have heard have benefited only those who preach it. Most of the political gospels that you and I have heard have benefited only the politicians. The social gospels have benefited only the sociologists. You and I need something right now that's going to benefit all of us, that's going to change the community in which we live, not try and take us somewhere else. We are African, and we happen to be in America. We're not American. We are people who formerly were Africans who were kidnapped and brought to America. Our forefathers weren't the pilgrims. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us. We were brought here against our will. We were not brought here to be made citizens. We were not brought here to enjoy the constitutional gifts that they speak so beautifully about today. Because we weren't brought here to be made citizens today, now that we've become awakened to some degree and we begin to ask for those things which they say are supposedly for Americans, they look upon us with hostility and unfriendliness. If you're interested in freedom, you need some judo, you need some karate, you need all the things that will help you fight for freedom. Nationalism is the wave of the present and the future. It is nationalism that's bringing freedom to oppressed people all over the world. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the Algerians. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the Nigerians and to the Ghanaians. It was nationalism that brought freedom to the people of Uganda and Tanganyika and Sudan and Somaliland. The Africans didn't get it by sitting in. They didn't get it by waiting in. They didn't get it by singing "We Shall Overcome." They got it through nationalism. And you and I will get it through nationalism. What is it that makes it difficult for the philosophy of nationalism to spread among the so-called Negroes? Number one, they think they have a stake in America. They think they have an investment in this country, which we do. We invested 310 years of slave labor, 310 years, every day of which your and my mother and father worked for nothing. Not 8 hours a day. There was no union in that day. They worked from sun up until sundown, from can't see in the morning until can't see at night. They never had a day off. And on Sunday, they were allowed to sit down and sing about when they die, they wouldn't be slaves no more. When they die, they wouldn't be slaves no more. They'd go up in the sky, and every day would be Sunday. That's a shame. And it is that 310 years of slave labor that went in, that was my and your contribution into this particular economy and political system. Make him give us the back pay. Let's join in. If this is what the Negro wants, let's join him. Let's show him how to struggle. Let's show him how to fight. Let's show him how to bring about a real revolution. Let's make him stop jiving. You don't need a debate. You don't need a filibuster. You need some action. So what you and I have got to do is get involved. You and I have to be right there breathing down their throat. Every time they look over their shoulder, we want them to see us. We want to make them pass the strongest civil rights bill they've ever passed. Because we know even after they pass it, they can't enforce it. In order to do this, we're starting a voters registration drive. We have to get everybody in Harlem registered, not as Democrats or Republicans, but registered as independents. We're going to organize a core of brothers and sisters who, after the city is mapped out, they won't leave one apartment house door not knocked on. There won't be a door in Harlem that will not have been knocked on to see that whatever black face lives behind that door is registered to vote by a certain time this year. Nobody will have an excuse not to be registered. We'll ask him, let us see your card. If you don't have the sense of responsibility to get registered, we'll move you out of town. It's going to be the ballot or the bullet.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and we're listening to Does Freedom of the Press Extend to State Secrets?
We're back to this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan of ABC News. Our motion is freedom of the press does not extend to state secrets. Debating for the motion, in support of the motion, Gabriel Schoenfeld and Michael Chertoff, against Alan Dershowitz and David Senger. And I'd like now to go to our audience to ask questions that will move this debate along. Thank you.
So is the against side saying that the press should never be prosecuted for any publishing of state secrets, any state secret? Is that the position?
That was a question. Yes. David Senger.
As a reporter, I would hope the prosecution wouldn't happen. But the reality is you have to establish a system in which the secrets that America is protecting are real secrets, like the bin Laden example that we were using before. But instead, we live in a system in which there are millions of pages classified each and every day. And you can't have a press that is living forever in the fear that the publication of any piece of data could lead to an equivalent prosecutorial discretion on this issue.
Michael Chertoff.
Well, I think the answer to the question, that there obviously are occasions when the press should be prosecuted for publication.
For publication
of state secrets. And the issue then
or
becomes,
some state secrets.
And the argument that David makes is, but the problem is it's too hard because there's too much classified material. And yet the facts show that when it comes time to make the decision to prosecute, government historically, whether it be Republicans or Democrats, have been very, very conservative and cautious in actually prosecuting. And that tells me the system works and that it is possible to have a workable system where people who are responsible journalists know where they can't go, and the irresponsible ones, dare I say Assange, may find themselves in a different
situation. And who decides who's responsible and irresponsible on the basis of what criteria? The issue is whether or not somebody should be punished for publishing state secrets. The answer to that is clearly no, not for publishing state secrets. If you want to have a list of things that can't be published, that's a very different criteria. You yourself conceded all three branches of government have to be involved. At the moment, the legislative branch hasn't been involved. They have punted. They have simply said, broadly defined state secrets, the Espionage Act, that has to be scrapped. And if you want to have 6, 9, 4 specific categories of things that can't be published, that's an interesting debate. And I think both of us
in
would
the
acknowledge.
Center there. Yeah. Yep.
So is the four side basically saying that the statement is correct, but it needs a big caveat of a wise judiciary system?
Now, I think what the four side is saying is that the statement is correct in the context of the government system in which we operate. That's why saying, well, you know, this is, we don't want to become like Egypt or Russia. That's not the context in which the proposition is offered. The proposition is offered in the context of our current system of government, in which part of the protection for the press is not just, quote, freedom of the press in the First Amendment, but it is the structure of government that says, if you actually want to take the step of prosecution, you've got to have an executive decision to prosecute. You've got a judge who will consider Alan Dershowitz's arguments about whether the law is properly written. And you'll have a jury of 12 people like you who will make the final decision.
And the worst possible solution is to
Alan
give
Dershowitz
the very same government that is being offended the power to make that decision. And if you think you can count on juries, just remember how juries operated during the McCarthy period. The First Amendment was built to protect the most unpopular, the most hated, during the worst periods of our history, and discretion is not going to serve that protection.
Gabriel Schoenfeld.
Solid laws.
Even if we take your suggestion
and
scrap the Espionage Act, which I would have trouble trusting the current Congress to do a better job than the one that wrote in 1917.
They couldn't do a worse job.
But even if we did that and we had a new set of laws that somehow managed to enumerate the very complex set of things that have to be protected. It's not just a little list of six, by the way. You still, if you had new laws, you'd still have juries, and you'd still have prosecutors making using their discretion. That's built into our system. It's not a perfect system. Name a better one.
Let me name a better one. We should have a rule that says you cannot, under any circumstances, publish the name of spies. And if the New York Times does it, they must be prosecuted. No room for discretion.
Thank you.
I'm confused by this sort of hard-line rule that disclosing the name of CIA agents is somehow something that should be absolutely prohibited. But should it be prohibited even when the name is revealed by an employee of the White House? Then there's this question of what is a secret? After a White House employee has leaked the secret, is it still a secret?
I think that
illustrates exactly why I think the current system works not perfectly, but as well as you can have in human existence. There's never an absolute. There are probably some times that you could reveal the identity of an agent when it's out there already, and you could argue that there's really no impact. There are other times when you're revealing other kinds of information that would be terribly devastating or damaging. We have a system for resolving a prosecution because we involve people like sitting in this room and 12 jurors in the box. And that is the protection that we have, that in the end, the law will be applied reasonably. And a reasonable application of the law is the best defense. A rigid application is one which is likely to wind up with exactly the kind of conundrum.
Well, here we really have a difference, because I think you need rigid application when it comes to the First Amendment. The First Amendment says, no, juries don't get to decide that. The Constitution prohibits that, just like the Constitution prohibits discrimination against the most absurd of all religions. The same law has to apply to all. You say nobody is in danger because there's no prosecution. There is currently in Virginia a grand jury investigation directed against WikiLeaks, but not against the New York Times.
The Times
published this too. Well, you're not going after them. Oh, no, we don't go after the Times. We go after WikiLeaks because they don't have the power.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
My fellow Americans, it's time for me to have an important conversation with my most trusted advisor. He's my friend. He's my conscience. He explains things to me when I don't understand them. And let's face it, that's a not small portion of the time. He's the one that taught me that FEMA is not a bone in the human leg. He explained to me that an HMO is not someone who's attracted to men. Mm-hmm. Y'all probably know him as Shooter. He's my Vice President Dick Cheney.
Good to see you. How are you? Nice to see you. What's up? Pleasure to see you. Mr. President, how is everything?
How's it going there, Dicko?
Well, Mr. President, I just would hope that you and all the other American people would understand that this is the first time that I have ever shot a man accidentally. Surely you understand that, Mr. President. I'd also like to say, I don't know why I'm getting all this grief. I went to visit the man I shot in the hospital.
You shot a man in the hospital, too?
Get on.
Okay. We're going to be joined by former administration aide, Scooter Libby, or as we call him, Scooby Looby. Of course, many people are questioning the people that I keep losing in my administration. You know, people left and right, I keep losing people involved with me, and I just want to assure all Americans that if I lose anyone else, don't worry. I stand ready to step up, take over.
And don't worry about things, Scooter. We're going to get you reinstated. We'll even get you back pay.
Thanks, Mr. Cheney.
We'll even pay you radioactively. When people asked about who leaked that agent, I pleaded ignorance. That's been my theme.
We all don't want to swim with shoes of cement. So Scooter's gonna take one for the team.
You want me steering the news away from you guys?
My polls are going lower than my grades at Yale.
Just walk the plank, we both will say thanks.
I'm so indicted.
gonna bite it.
I'm less popular than him and I'm unindicted, so it's decided.
I was misguided.
They know, they know, they know, they know, they know, they got you, they got you.
I'll get a lawyer and I won't take chances. They're gonna offer me some kind of deal.
Just plead exterminating circumstances.
Or maybe like Ned Beatty, I will squeal.
Right now I'm freaking, leaking right into my trousers.
If I tattle, that'll lead to both of you.
Don't go that trail, I'm too cute for jail.
Don't be short-sighted,
then help me fight it.
Well, if we have a good excuse, hey, I think they'll buy it.
Hey, let's all try it.
I am not a crook.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Judith Miller.
Mission accomplished.
Oh, done!
And now back to, does freedom of the press extend to state secrets?
Isn't that a great example? I didn't want to bring up the WikiLeaks, but since you have, I will.
Sure.
Isn't that a great example of the fact that attributing ill motive to juries or to prosecutors or government omits the fact that there can be ill motive on the publisher. In the case of Assange, it's reported that his purpose in leaking the information is because he wants to make it impossible for the U.S. government to function by making it impossible for secrets to be held so that people can't have conversations. So he's motivated by ill will to the United States. Now, is this the man we want to trust if, God forbid, he got a hold of the bin Laden attack plan? Do we want to trust him to exercise his judgment?
Do we want to trust
people like those in this room?
Do we want a prosecutor? Do we want to trust the prosecutor who misstates what Assange said and what his motive was because he doesn't like Assange? Do we know what the motive of the New York Times is? Is it to sell advertising? Is it to be powerful? Is it to help the government? A motive analysis to be limiting freedom of the press would mean the end of the First Amendment.
Sir?
Obviously, this is not a debate of absolutes, and it seems that the point of discretion keeps coming up over and over again. So it's a question of who do you really trust when there can be abuses on both sides? Who has the most information to make that decision? Who has the most information to make the decision, and where is the greater risk? As much as I love the First Amendment, I'd like to pose that
David
question.
David Sanger.
Clearly, as any government official will happily tell you, they've got a wider range of information than the newspapers do. And the government would make the argument that they're in a much better position to judge. That would be a very convincing argument if, in fact, the government, when doing its classification, had to do in a serious, credible way a measure between security risk and public's right to know. But the fact of the matter is, as someone in the CIA said to me just last week, no one ever got fired for stamping classified on a piece of paper.
And we should add that the other side has not really addressed this whole striking example of the SWIFT program, where the Times revealed an ongoing operational intelligence gathering program directed at al-Qaeda's finances.
One chance to respond.
Absolutely.
Do you want to respond? Was the Times wrong to report on the SWIFT program? Was anything gained for the public interest?
The Times was not wrong to report on it because the SWIFT program had been written about in many forms over many years before and after al-Qaeda became a significant source and issue. That is the only way international transactions flow and get cleared. And it was obvious to anybody who had read anything in any detail about how international transactions are going that that's where they go through.
But let's assume for a moment the Times was wrong. You didn't prosecute the Times. You don't have the guts to prosecute the Times. You will never prosecute the Times.
I actually do.
You are a bunch of bullies.
You said you agree with that?
You will go after only the weakest and the most vulnerable. The First Amendment is not about the New York Times. The First Amendment is about Drudge. The First Amendment is about extremist newspapers and magazines that are very unpopular. The First Amendment is about people who could never win a case in front of a jury. That's who the First Amendment is about. I don't worry about the New York Times. They can defend themselves. They knock down trees by the forestfuls. Governments don't go after newspapers like the New York Times.
As someone who has actually published state secrets and been taken to court for it, I find all of this four guys dancing around the head of a pin. Michael Chertoff came closest when he said that some state secrets are worthy of protection and others are not. And the question is really among you, who should decide that?
That's right.
And I think you actually all agree that this is a debate about who should decide.
Thomas Jefferson once said, "The law should be so crystal clear that you should be able to understand it if you read it while running." And there is nothing vaguer than the Espionage Act of 1917. It gives the government total power to decide who to prosecute. We need to have rules of law, not counting on the discretion of prosecutors, the discretion of juries to protect our First Amendment. It's just too valuable.
Very quickly for Michael Chertoff.
I do think the questioner absolutely put the question that really is dividing us, which is who decides. And I would argue, and I think our proposition will be at the end of the day, that it is the combination of Congress having passed the law, the executive branch making its decision to prosecute, and the judge and the jury, you people, deciding whether to convict or not. That's where the ultimate decision has to be made, not in WikiLeaks or in Julian Assange's living room.
And that concludes round two of this debate. And here's where we are. We are about to hear brief closing statements from each debater. And remember how you voted before the debate, because we'll be asking you right after these closing statements to vote again, and the team that has changed the most minds will be declared our winner. On to round three, closing statements. Our motion is, freedom of the press does not extend to state secrets. And here to summarize his position against the motion, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times.
In 29 years as a reporter, I've learned that on two things, we almost always get it wrong. Whenever something has been leaked to me and I read stories later on about who the leaker was, it's almost invariably wrong, which tells you people get the motivations wrong. My own estimate about what the effects are of publishing a given story is also almost always wrong. It's very difficult as you go in and write something to know whether or not it is actually going to have a very deleterious effect. The hard question is, what do you do to make sure that the press in the United States can force the government to debate policy on the most important questions? Whether or not we invade a country and have the right evidence to go do so. Whether or not we use a new weapon, whether it is a nuclear weapon in 1945 or a cyber weapon in 2011. You cannot do that unless you have a bias in favor of publication. One that will make sure that the republic holds together because we have made ourselves different by pressing for publication whenever there is doubt.
Thank you, David Sanger. Our motion is freedom of the press does not extend to state secrets. And here to summarize his position for the motion, Gabriel Schoenfeld, author of Necessary Secrets, National Security, the Media, and the Rule of Law.
I agree with David Sanger on his last point that we should have a system that has a bias in favor of publication, including a legal bias. And I think that's there's room for reform. But our government leaks like a sieve, and the press publishes secrets all the time. But I'm just reminded of an episode that occurred in late 2009 when a New York Times reporter, one of your colleagues, David Rode, was kidnapped by the Taliban. And Bill Keller, the executive editor of the paper, made the executive decision to withhold that information from the public. And the idea was he didn't want to do anything that would endanger Rhodes' life. And all honor to Bill Keller for that. They protected the lives of their guy. But when the decision involves non-journalists, it can't be a voluntary decision up to Bill Keller. And that's why we have laws on the books that in the final analysis do allow for the prosecution of the journalists when they publish not just the random things that are stamped secret for no good reason, but the genuine, really hardcore secrets that place our lives in danger, including some of the things that your newspaper has published, like the Swift story, once again.
Thank you, Gabriel Schoenfeld. Our motion is freedom of the press does not extend to state secrets. And here to summarize his position against the motion, Alan Dershowitz, the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard.
The proposition, freedom of the press does not extend to state secrets, is far more dangerous than any of the state secrets that have allegedly been leaked during the 200 and some years of our republic. That's why the other side has to add genuine or real or some. And I urge you to vote against this proposition, because if this proposition is passed, it sends an extremely dangerous message to the government that it continue business as usual. And the current situation is very clear. Anything that's published relating to national security today could be subject to prosecution. What we need is specific, legislatively enacted rules that say that no one, not a favorable press, not an unfavorable press, can ever, under any circumstances, reveal fact A, fact B, fact C. You don't trust juries and prosecutors with broad, overarching criminal statutes when it comes to the First Amendment. You narrow, you limit, and then you give it to the jury. But the last institution that should be making the decision who to prosecute is the very institution that is criticized by these revelations. So I urge you, do not support this proposition. This proposition is dangerous to your liberty. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan Dershowitz.
Up next, Huey Long. Huey Long, nicknamed Kingfish, was an American politician who served as the 40th governor of Louisiana from 1928 to 1932 and as a member of the United States Senate from 1932 until his assassination in 1935.
How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub he ain't got no business.
Now, how are you going to feed the balance of the people? What's Morgan and Baruch and Rockefeller and Mellon going to do with all that grub? They can't eat it. They can't wear the clothes. They can't live in the house. But when they've got everything on the God's living earth that they can eat and they can wear and they can live in, and all that their children can live in and wear and eat and all their children's children can use, then we got to call Mr. Morgan and Mr. Mellon and Mr. Rockefeller back and say, come back here. Well, sit back on this table here that you took away from here that you don't need. Leave something else for the American people to consume.
And now for something completely different.